Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast presentation titled Managing Overactive Bladder, From Dual Diagnoses to Geriatric Challenges. I'm Dr. Wayne Kwong. I'm a urologist in Albuquerque, New Mexico. In recognition of Bladder Awareness Month, this MedCast series delves into the complexities of overactive bladder management across different patient populations. From exploring gender-specific challenges in the dual diagnosis of OAB and benign prostatic hyperplasia, BPH, to addressing the unique needs of elderly patients, the series provides a comprehensive look at the latest treatment strategies and patient care approaches. So please join us for this in-depth discussion on improving quality of life for all affected by OAB. Joining us in this conversation is Dr. Bilal Chugtai, MD, a urologist in Northwell Health Physician Partners. Dr. Chugtai, if you could also just add to that who you are, what you've done, and where you're coming from.
Absolutely. So my name is Bilal Chugtai. I'm the chief of urology at Plainview Hospital, which is a large community hospital. My area of specialization, or the area that I've always been interested in, is voiding dysfunction in both men and women. So OAB is a condition that I see really commonly. It's also a condition that I've done a fair amount of research in as well.
And he's being modest, not just a fair amount, a lot of research. And I think just a real addition to this conversation about OAB. And it allows us to really kind of jump into the pathophysiological differences in OAB between men and women. And there's something that you've said that I think all urologists could really hold on to, which is that we often blame the organ we own. And if we could dive into that a little bit, I think it's a beautiful phrase.
Yeah. So I think a lot of times, I mean, we're all busy in practice, right? So I think we've come to, you know, have a way that we approach each patient, whether it's men or women, right? And I think traditionally, when it comes to men presenting in the office, we go to blaming the prostate. They might describe urgency, frequency, small volume voids, urge incontinence, but automatically we go, that's prostate. And when women present, we automatically go with the exact same symptoms. We go, that must be overactive bladder. Now, obviously with some men, they are going to be presenting with BPH, and that's probably true probably 2/3 of the time. But probably 30% of the time, these men likely have overactive bladder. And as they start their journey and they go through, you know, either medications or minimally invasive therapies, you know, we're sort of targeting not the correct organ. So in some ways, yeah, but when men present, we're typically blaming the prostate. When women present, we blame their bladders.
And how do these differences, that subtle difference, influence kind of the treatment approach that you have with the men and the women?
I think in a lot of ways, I think it's really important asking the question, like, what is the symptom that bothers you the most? So sometimes, like, you know, boiling it down to, like, is it the nocturia? Is it the urgency? Is it the frequency? And patients will tell you, like, hey, I just get up too many times at night. And obviously that's a different pathway altogether. But a lot of times they'll tell you, like, I just don't want to leak on the way to the bathroom. And you go, ah, well, that's, you know, very suspicious for overactive bladder. And I think when you have men who have that, in addition to, you know, I ask the question, like, do you have a weak stream? Do you have a strong stream? I think elucidating when it's more bladder oriented can be very helpful for us to figure out which pathway to follow. Is it more of a enlarged prostate pathway or more of an overactive bladder pathway?
And you and I have talked about this, but I've seen you talk about how do we define or drill deeper into that relationship between BPH and OAB in men? Like, how's a good way to kind of frame it or understand it?
I think it's tough because, I mean, if you look at our diagnostics that we've had, right, our diagnostics are an IPSS, right? And that's assuming that you use an IPSS, which obviously validated questionnaire. But in that questionnaire, there are questions that come up to, you know, storage and emptying. So that's one way that we could sort of come up with what pathway maybe to follow, right? In addition to that, we've got the uroflow, right? And we have the post-void residual. I think it's really using those three tools together in terms of, let's say you have a patient that presents, you've got a pretty good flow. You've got a volume that's smaller, let's say, you know, 150 to 200 cc's, a really low post-void residual. I think that gives you a higher index of suspicion to think that it's bladder oriented, right? So in other words, hey, maybe we should be looking more at the bladder versus the prostate. I mean, a lot of patients present and they're always in the middle, right? You've got that post, you got that ureal flow of 125. You've got this Q max of maybe like 17, right? Just high enough where you're like, is it obstruction? Is it not? I mean, there are a lot of diagnostic challenges in this space. I think a lot of times it's really using the history and having that conversation with the patient to sort of figure out what steps you want to take.
If you had to kind of imagine a future, kind of like a magic wand, kind of how would we engage these men to talk about their OAB, to really understand that they need to take care of it or engage with you to find the right diagnostics, to find the right therapies? Like, have you found some good tips and strategies to really help them engage into that diagnostic process?
That's a great question. And I think what's hard is that in our practices, right, we have the motivated patient or the, you know, the patient who's seeking treatment. I mean, there's a lot of people who suffer for a long time, right? You know, the average person with the overactive bladder may suffer an average of 5 to 7 years before telling their primary care doctor, right? So I think in a lot of ways, like, we're programmed to cope. And I think urinary issues have become, you know, a quote, like, natural part of aging, right? And I think it's a lot of changing that stigma of like, no, this isn't a natural part of aging, and this is something that we can actually address. When patients come in, I think asking the question about symptoms and bother, I think, is a good way to sort of understand it. And also letting patients know there are a slew of treatments, all the way from, you know, pills, injections, the use of neurostimulators. I think that's an important way for them to realize that there's a multitude of options for them.
And you touched upon it, kind of that first layer. And I've seen you talk about, you know, a good diary, for example, right? Understanding or even reporting a history of their urge incontinence or retention and so forth. And you're layering on IPSS, PVR, Euroflow. What's the next level? Or like, kind of how do you move folks through that paradigm for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think bladder diaries are wonderful, but at the same time, the compliance for them has always been really low. And I would say that's true for my patients as well. And what's your experience, Wayne?
Yeah, it's very hard for people to keep up. I mean, I can barely keep up with a checkbook or, you know, those types of things.
Same. Or my text messages. No, I agree. So I think that's a great way to first start. But I think when you're talking about pills, right, a lot of times you don't want to get into invasive urodynamics, right? But I think urodynamics are a great way for us to understand obstruction versus overactivity, you know, versus storage versus emptying symptoms, right? I think there's also the utilization of Urocuff, but Urocuff is really good for obstruction, but it's not really great for storage symptoms, though.
I think it's going to be interesting as we migrate forward with the advent of remote diagnostics, right? Can you kind of speak to that? Because I know you've got a finger on that pulse, and I think a lot of the listeners would really benefit from your understanding of how, what a vision looks like for you when you see the landscape of male LUTs.
Yeah, I think we are starting to see a bunch of sound-based apps. I've been using ProudP and I've been doing research with them. But there's other ones as well that can also help. There's also the use of CarePath, which has a Bluetooth device. There's also the utilization of, I think it's IU, I think there's other ones that actually use like a hat, essentially, that measures uroflows as well. But I think when we get multiple repeated measurements, while the patient is in the comfort of their own home, right, we really get an idea and a sense of what's really happening. Because when we do uroflows in the office, you know, every patient's like, I just peed, right? Or there's something that, you know, like as a result, it's kind of like, it's not an accurate measurement. So it's very hard to get, you know, a good single uroflow to hang your hat on to be like, this is the diagnosis. I think it's also exciting that we've got Bright Uro coming along too, which is the ambulatory urodynamics. I think that's also going to be a push in the right direction to help us understand multiple filling and emptying cycles.
And I think you really highlight that we need to recognize we've achieved so much in this golden era of BPH, BPO therapeutics, but we're really seeing the rise of the golden era of bladder diagnostics. And I think that's super exciting. How do we identify at-risk bladders, get those bladder health baselines? Why? Because it affects the quality of life. And I think you've I've seen you talk about this, and if you can share a little bit, how does OAB adversely impact the quality of life for all these men, these women, the elderly? Where have you seen that in your practice, and you know, what are things we can do?
Yeah, I mean, I would tell you that in my practice, when you see patients who are suffering with a overactive bladder complex, I mean, these are patients who typically will tell you stories of, you know, I haven't left the house, I can't go to the movies, I stopped exercising, it's hard for me to see my friends. I'm also very afraid that if I go to a restaurant, will I stand up with a puddle of urine in my seat? I don't want to be embarrassed, right? There's also a fear of odor, leakage, you know, breakdown, you know, also like the sequelae of incontinence as well. And we know that there's a very strong correlation between overactive bladder, depression, anxiety, social isolation. So it's definitely one of those conditions where, I mean, it has a really significant effect on the quality of life of our patients.
Yeah, and I think I just looked up some statistics. I think like with social isolation, I think it increases your mortality or risk of mortality early on by like 30%. And then loneliness increases that risk by 15%. I mean, it doesn't help if you're leaking down your leg, you know, to feel more included in this world.
It's true. I mean, in addition to, I mean, unfortunately, I feel like none of us really get healthier as we get older, right? And as our mobility may get a little bit more limited, right? Once you add on something like overactive bladder complex and the things that go with it, obviously they can have significant impact in how you interact with your peers, colleagues, friends, loved ones.
I have a kind of an odd question. Let's envision a world where men did not have prostates, but they had a bladder. What does that look like over time? Do you think it would mirror women who are nulliparous? Or kind of what are your thoughts on that?
That's a great question, because I mean, we've all done cystoscopies. I mean, we've all talked about the level of trabeculations, diverticulums, right? And I mean, when we see women as they age, their bladders have trabeculations, they have diverticulums, right? And when we see this in both men and women. And I think, Wayne, your analogy of this bladder health to cardiac health, I think is a great one. And I think it really highlights the fact that, you know, there's a given number of heartbeats that we have, and then our heart teeters out, right? Our bladder's probably the same. It's got a given number of contractions, and then it teeters out. And there's probably some type of life cycle to it with, you know, increased contractions, maybe some overactivity over time. And then over time, maybe there is some failure that occurs in both men and women.
I like it. So the heart only has so many heartbeats. The bladder only has so many squeezes, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I think it's important because it segues into something that we've been thinking about, and it's hard for us to tease out BPH and OAB, right? Because on the landscape of male LUTs, there's aging, there's neurologic contribution, pelvic floor, metabolic syndrome, strictures, primary bladder neck obstruction. When you think about this, kind of what are your fears about long-term clinical implications of delayed diagnosis of treating OAB? Let's first start with women and then kind of migrate to men. Like for women, what are you worried about?
I mean, when it comes to overactive bladder, it's hard to say what happens to a, you know, this is one place where we just don't have a lot of data. We don't have a lot of data on the natural history of these diseases, right? So at the end of the day, when overactive bladder patients present, it's not common for us to take this patient and sort of go, let's see what happens over time. Do your symptoms, you know, progress and get worse, which I think a lot of them do. Do they get better? It's hard to say, right? So we don't have that natural progression data for overactive bladder. But I would imagine that you know, you take these patients and there's probably, like, you know, what we've talked about before, there may be a window of opportunity where the bladder may respond better. Maybe the bladder would respond better to conservative therapies. And as that condition worsens, maybe, you know, your chance of improvement gets less and less. So, you know, the same analogy occurs with enlarged prostate, where there's probably a point where the bladder does teeter out. And that overactivity may lead to a shorter, let's say, a shorter life for that overall bladder, whether it's from OAB or BPH.
And when you paint a picture of progression of disease for OAB specifically, how do you frame detrusor overactivity and then detrusor overactivity impaired contractility? Like, I'm still learning about this because I haven't stayed on top of that, but I understand that's evolving. The language is evolving, our understanding about detrusor underactivity is evolving. And kind of where do you sit on all that?
Yeah, no, I think detrusor underactivity is a lot more common than we think, right? I think a lot of patients that do present, like for example, when I'm doing urodynamics in women prior to, let's say, some of the third line therapies or the ones that have, you know, confounding things where we need urodynamics, you'll see like sometimes they've got not the strongest contraction or that bladder doesn't empty very well, but their primary complaint is urgency frequency. And that patient's always a lot more challenging to treat than the one that empties completely or that has a, you know, more like a stronger bladder.
And then for men, kind of how do you find that role for urodynamics in a similar fashion for women, or how do you navigate that?
I would say, again, it's where diagnostic uncertainty lies. So in other words, if men come in and you've got, you know, urgency, frequency, you can't get a good uroflow. You've tried a couple of medications, some alpha blockers, some beta threes, maybe an anticholinergic. Patient's not getting better. You need a path to follow. You're not sure which one. I think urodynamics can help you sort of identify like, hey, this looks more like obstruction or this looks more like a primary bladder problem.
And do you think there's a role for urodynamics in kind of helping prognosticate or prevent unnecessary surgeries or to help with multimodality planning for OAB and BPH, or is there data emerging about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think our current studies on urodynamics have demonstrated that it doesn't necessarily change management, right? So in other words, whether you look at that in men or women, I mean, it seems like it may not change the management. But I do think that, you know, having a patient undergo a fill cycle and an empty cycle, and you sort of have that conversation with them in terms of like when they have their urgency, when they have an urgent continent episode, or when they're voiding. I mean, I think you can get a fair amount of information to help you point in one direction or the other.
And when you get that information, I guess it depends on where you are practicing, but you practice pretty close to New York City, I imagine.
I'm 45 minutes away.
But it's highly, I presume, some educated patients and so forth who want answers and want things fixed. Kind of what is your algorithm for tackling the first, like what's the successful ingredients to a successful first OAB clinical visit with you? Like where you feel like, yeah, we got the top three things we needed to cover.
Yeah. So I would say like, when patients come in, I do stick pretty close to the guidelines. So patients come in, they've got urgency, they've got frequency, let's just say urgent continence. I mean, I'm getting, you know, a patient history, usually some type of validated instrument. In men, typically use an IPSS, and women will typically use an OAB. Actually, we typically use a PFDI 20 to try to get some urinary symptoms, you know, sexual symptoms, as well as colon symptoms as well. And then we typically will get a post-void residual, we'll get urine as well, right? And a lot of times I ask the patient, like, what is your goal? Like, in other words, we started this visit and I tell them, look, my first visit is really to rule out all the big bad things. Let's rule out infection. Let's rule out any red blood cells. Let's rule out abnormal cells, right? Let's start with that. And tell me what your goal is as well. And some patients will go, well, I just want to make sure I didn't have cancer, right? Great. So that's the route we're going to take. I mean, we're not going to do a cysto on everybody, but we're going to look for microhematuria, look for, you know, atypical cytology. But some patients will go, look, I really want to try to find, you know, I don't want meds. I don't want a procedure. I want some way to get better. So we talk about dietary changes, avoiding caffeine, you know, limiting fluid intake at certain times of the day. Other patients will tell me, look, this is really bothering me. I want a solution right away. And those patients will talk about, you know, upfront, you know, second and third line therapies, including oral meds and third line therapies.
And is that for women only, or same approach for men, or because they have that prostate that they own, that you have to change that kind of track?
I would say it's pretty similar for both populations. I think for men, obviously, we're talking about PSAs for age-appropriate men. We're also talking about the use of Uroflow in men as well at some point. But I really try to hone in on sort of like what is the goal of the patient? Like, what are you trying to accomplish? What's the purpose of your visit?
And if you could kind of create a picture of what I really enjoy about you is you have this beautiful balance between evidence-based medicine and patient-centered medicine, which I think is a craft. It's an art form that I think you've gotten dialed in. But are there strategies that our patients can use to better advocate for timely intervention, whether it's showing up in your office, pharmaceuticals, non-invasive, invasive therapies for OAB? Kind of how do you, if you had a wish list for skill sets for patients to have to really advocate for timely intervention for their OAB, what would it be like?
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent question. I think what's really hard is that, you know, we're working in a space where we don't have a biomarker, right? We're diagnosing on symptoms. So a lot of times patients will go, it's not that bad. And it's like, but you're wearing 3 pads a day. Like, what do you mean it's not that bad? Right. So I think it's hard because I think there's some patients who are risk adverse and they will, you know, do their best to avoid any intervention. Then you have patients who are, you know, they'll be leaking a very small amount and they're very like motivated to get the treatment, you know, pursue treatment. I don't think we have a great sort of like, hey, this is, you know, mild OAB, this is moderate and severe. It's kind of like we're doing that based on symptoms.
Do you think we could? Yeah, I think it's hard for us to find out how to ignite patients, right, to take action. I think on our part, at least, like when I have a guy fill out the IPSS, it's in their handwriting. They've done it by hand. And I ask them to own it. And I also ask them to recognize and hear it from me, Mr. Smith, this is not okay.
Yeah.
And simply saying that, I think, has power. Like, hey, we need to now work together to rectify this. To be getting up 3 times a night for the next 20 to 30 years, yeah, that's just not okay. You can't be the best version of yourself when you're not sleeping, right? You don't have energy or you're not leaving the house, right?
No, absolutely. I think, unfortunately, a lot of patients have that stigma of this is a natural part of aging. And I think I agree with you. I think filling out the IPSS or sometimes asking the question in terms of like, well, you're getting up 3 times a night. Does that mean you're napping the next day? Yeah, I got to take a 3-hour nap. It's like, okay, so your sleep is disturbed. You're napping in the middle of the day. Well, I can't really exercise because I can't leave the house. I can't, you know, every 45 minutes, I got to know where a bathroom is. And yeah, I agree. I think there's something about being like, you know, there's solutions to this. You know, there's things that we can do. But going from that patient who's like unactivated, like I guess, you know, that's a good term, like the activated patient. I think it's definitely a challenge. And it's definitely a challenge in terms of like how to explain to patients like what is normal and what they're willing to tolerate as well.
We started talking about educational tools like in the urinal. Maybe if a guy is like, it can measure one day your Q max in the urinal at the football game and some red light will start flashing or something. Hey, you've got a problem, right? How do we bring that awareness? And I think one of the things we can do is maybe rethink about the IPSS. And I kind of use it as an invitation where I kind of bring guys in like, hey, I just want you to know we made a mistake. It says International Prostate Symptom Score. But I'll let you in on a secret. It's actually also about the bladder, right? And it begins to engage patients. They're like, first of all, they like to hear about a secret in medical healthcare that no one knows about. But I think that it's a great opportunity to start into the spiel about bladder health. And do you have a way that you talk to your men who have BPH and OAB to kind of bring in the bladder, like a certain track or talk track that you use?
Yeah, I mean, for me, a lot of times I show the patient, we start off with the IPSS. We also look at the uroflow together. I show the patient the uroflow and go, all right, well, this is what your flow is. And then I'll draw right over it and go, hey, this is what a normal flow looks like. And they'll go, oh, okay, well, and then I'll also ask them, is what you urinated today, is that typical, right? And some men will go, no, I usually pee a little bit more, you're a little bit stronger, a little bit weaker, whatever it might be, right? And then that segues into the whole like, hey, so we have the bladder, we have the prostate, right? The bladder's got 2 big responsibilities. One is storage, The other one is emptying when it's socially appropriate. I mean, to me, it seems like your bladder's like not doing well from a storage standpoint. It's not holding enough urine. And then from the emptying, you're leaving a whole bunch behind, right? And I think it really does help them understand sort of like, this is what your bladder is supposed to do. And this is the way the prostate's supposed to be. And it segues nicely into, hey, how are we going to address this underlying issue?
I have a small question for you. Something that I've always had a pet peeve with is the comparison between the prostate and a walnut. We need to leave the walnut alone, right? I think it should be a crusade because walnuts, first of all, anatomically, what we really should be talking about is a mini donut about the size of a golf ball. Poor walnut. It's a healthy nut. We should be eating those things. Instead, it's being like blamed for men's symptoms. I don't know if that's something you could get on board with, but how do you kind of explain the prostate to guys and its relationship?
Funny you say that. I typically use the analogy of your prostate is like a donut and it's squeezing the urethra. And I literally like, this is your prostate and it's, here's like the hole in the middle and it's squeezing the urethra. And ultimately I was like, the outside of the prostate probably doesn't matter so much. It's really the inside where when it clamps down on that urethra, you get poor flow and then your bladder screams in return and your bladder screams by getting you urgency, frequency, incomplete emptying. But you're right. I think the walnut is because of its inherent shape, like the outside's correct, but what really matters is the inside and the walnut doesn't represent that well.
I'm hoping that one day, because it's not just size as you and I talk about. And as you know, I'm a big advocate of the trifecta, right? We should be making those choices based on prostate size, prostate shape, and detrusor function. However we assess that. And I'm hoping that one day, do you think like if you had to look into the distance that we will get to a point where guidelines are advocating the preservation of bladder health, or what is it going to take for us to get there to make OAB, urge incontinence, more in the spotlight to share space on the red carpet with the prostate?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely an opportunity as we're getting more and more treatments. I think it's amazing to be part of this field right now. We've got tremendous innovation in enlarged prostate. We've got tremendous innovation coming down the down the line of diagnostics and in the OAB space as well, right? We've got these novel implants for tibial nerve. There's new nerves being looked at as well. So I think it's a very, very exciting times. I also think that as we get more treatment, there's this natural awareness of patients, right? And patients just become more aware of like a certain treatment that may sing to them, being like, oh, wow, that sounds like something that could really work for me. So I do think that down the horizon, I think there's an opportunity to definitely diagnose and treat more patients. But I do think that right now with our current diagnostics is definitely limitations, right? We're really counting on the patient's bother to bring them in, right? And then once they have the bother, right, it's sort of like then we're talking them through that bother. But there's a dance, right? I mean, I'm sure, Wayne, when you see a patient that walks in, right,
yeah,
and patient goes, I just want to do, diet and, some behavioral changes. And they've got like three pads a day. They've got this like, crazy post-void residual. And you're like, that's not what you need. Like, I know, like, you're going to need some form of, pharmacotherapy, minimally invasive therapy, whatever it might be. But if you take that patient and you present something they're not ready for, that patient gets turned off. So I do think that it's part of our like education, is part of like that process that the patient has to go through.
Are there advancements in that educational outreach that you feel are necessary that to improve for us to kind of get the message out to the public and about OAB? Like, have you seen successful things in New York or?
No, I think we don't have a great, there's educational resources, right? But as you know, like if you do a Google search, right, you end up with some confusing information and not all of it is high quality. Same is true when you look at any of the social media things that are out there. So I think it's hard for patients because when they Google like the symptoms, right, depending on the terminologies that they use, they may be bombarded with things that may not be great for them. So I think there's definitely a role for us to educate patients in terms of, what is overactive bladder? What is normal? What are treatment options, right? I think there's definitely an opportunity for us to really, expand the field in that sense.
I'd love to get your input on something, which I guess my style is to kind of lay it out. And I guess I use a little bit of fear, because I education with a little touch of fear, because I think that drives men to be willing to take off their armor of masculinity and understand that they're not fine. And if they don't choose to take care of this problem, it can lead to consequences down the road. And as you know, I'm a big advocate on the five stages of bladder health that I came up with. But from your standpoint, is it too much? And I'm okay if it's just my approach, but like stage one, right? We talked about it, that mini donuts growing tight, things are slowing down, stage one. Stage two, that bladder muscle now, just like the heart muscle, is working harder, right? Squeezing urine, it begins to struggle, it becomes overactive, causing urgency, frequency, getting up in the middle of the night. Then if you don't take care of it, the bladder can act out like a rebellious child, contract without permission, causing urge incontinence, stage three. And if you really don't take care of it for men, just like the heart can have a heart attack, the bladder can suddenly stop working, causing the emergency of retention. And like the heart that can go into heart failure, the bladder can go into bladder failure, causing a lifetime of catheterizations. And worst case scenario, the heart can always still be transplanted. The bladder isn't so lucky, right? And so when I frame it like that, I'm saying, hey, Mr. Smith, right now you're in stage two and you're knocking on the door of stage three, because sometimes you think you're not going to make it, and we together, we need to get the data to make sure you don't get to stage three, four, and five. Now, it oversimplifies it, because as you and I both know, male LUTS is far more complicated than just BPO.
Yeah. I think your approach is like, I like your approach, right? I think it definitely generates a lot of hypothesis and a lot of thinking about it. But obviously with like the stages, we don't have great evidence that this is the evolution for every patient. And obviously some patients may skip steps and, do varieties of that. I think it's hard to say what resonates with each patient, right? I'm sure there's different patient types and certain things resonate with certain patients. Like, I think there's definitely patients who are very proactive. Like, they come in, they've got this PVR of 200 and you go, well, bladder's not emptying. You've got this Qmax that's on the lower side. And that patient's like, well, how do we fix it? What are we doing? Like, you don't need to create fear for that patient, right? Then there's other patients who will see that and they kind of go, well, it doesn't bother me. Why should I fix it? And, you explain, hey, look, your bladder's not emptying completely. There's urine left behind. And they're like, so, right? And I think there's definitely an opportunity for education and explaining, what does that lower Qmax mean? What does urinary retention mean, right? Like, I'll have some patients that go, well, what's the worst that's going to happen? I'll have to catheterize myself. And I go, yes. And they go, okay, I get it. I accept that as a consequence, right? Like, how would you manage that patient?
Yeah, that's fascinating. So I have to paint a picture of what they can live and live without, right? And that, I don't know if they have the full understanding when they're like, oh, catheterization, 4 to 5 days of, 4 to 5 times a day, to really, like, we have to take the time to explain the morbidity of that, UTIs or strictures or the smell or et cetera, right? And I think that we can do a better job of that together. And I think one avenue that I'm excited to explore is sexual health. I just had a guy come in, 55-year-old, BPO, OAB. He can't ejaculate if he thinks he's about to pee. And it makes it very difficult. So that can be a very motivating reason for men to self-ignite, to engage in the diagnostic acquisition of data to make better decisions about, better data drives better decision-making. And I'm not sure how you feel about like the avenue or the perspective of sexual health, kind of your thoughts.
Yeah, so I think there's an intimate link that as we get older, we're at risk for urinary symptoms. We're at risk for erectile dysfunction, ejaculatory dysfunction, and we know as you get older, the rates get higher, right? And is there a role for preserving, you know, sexual function by addressing underlying, you know, BPO? Maybe, right? I don't think we have great data for that, but I mean, there is some data when you look at some of the minimally invasive therapy, like the trials, where you'll see slight improvement of sexual function over time for the men who had their symptoms treated. We saw that in the ITIN trial. Like when we did a subgroup analysis looking at sexual health, we saw a trend towards improved sexual function. Now, I don't tell patients like that's the reason to treatment, but I agree. I think there's an opportunity for, you know, what sings to patients, right? And using that as a driver for appropriate care.
And kind of switching gears, because I think you touched upon it before, which is when those patients come into your office for that first clinical visit, what role are primary care providers in your area kind of playing to help you with early detection, diagnostic accuracy, other comorbidities and management of OAB, or how would you like all of us to interact or work together with primary care docs? Because that's been a subject on this series so far as well.
Yeah, no, I think primary care doctors have a very, they have a challenging role. I mean, the internist, you know, is managing everything, right? And yeah. When you talk about like cholesterol, blood pressure, you know, A1C, you know, there's other risk factors. I mean, the problem is like they have to cover a lot of information, a lot of screenings in a very short period of time. And, you know, like down the road, I think CMS is adding additional things like with depression screening and other things that are a vital part of, you know, the patient journey for primary care. I think it would be great if we had some type of, you know, easy question for them to incorporate and sort of like, hey, you know, like for example, if something doesn't bother you, I guess you don't really think about it, right? Like for example, if you don't have an earache, you're not aware of your ear, right? You're not really thinking about it. It's just there and you don't like actively think about it, right? But your bladder, right? Like is your bladder something you think about, right? Is like, is urination that something on your mind? Does it affect your quality of life? Right. And I feel like if we had a trigger question to incorporate, that could be a great way to segue that conversation towards, you know, triggering that referral to a urologist.
They talked about the primary care discussion of using a threshold of over 50 cc's on a PVR for a referral. I was explaining that I felt like we might have to find some compromise in there, because otherwise we could end up seeing a lot of maybe way too many patients that we could handle. Kind of what are your feelings on that PVR kind of concept of 50 cc's?
I mean, I think what's hard about that is that, I think it's a wonderful idea of having like, hey, what if we gave them an objective measure, right? You get a post-void and this is a great way. But first thing is a lot of primaries don't do post-void residuals. They don't have ultrasounds available to them. I think using a cutoff, it's hard to say what that cutoff should be. Is it 50? Is it 75? Hard to say, right? But at the same time, I think if there was a way for us to really think about, like, for example, if you think about depression, right? There's a single question that they use to screen for depression, right? If you think about like even diabetes, it's really an A1C. It's a single thing that they're looking for that really helps them figure out their last few months of sugar control. Like if we had some type of, I guess, litmus test for that, that would be really helpful.
Something I just want to throw out is one of the things I'm hoping to really explore is bladder health screening starting at the age of 50 for men when we talk about LUTs and so forth. What are your thoughts or impressions if we say like IPSS 8 and above and with or without Qmax less than 15, PVR greater than 100. Could you work with that, or how would you modify?
Yeah, so I think in our practices, I think a lot of us do that, right? Like for example, let's say you're seeing someone with a kidney stone, right? Or, you know, like a upper tract asymptomatic stone, right? Or a renal cyst or a hematuria workup, right? I still have a lot of these patients fill out IPSS just to screen in terms of like, do you have significant urinary symptoms? And I'm surprised a lot of, you know, men and women will be like, yeah, I mean, I have to urinate every hour throughout the day. I just thought it was, I just thought it was normal. I thought I had a small bladder. I thought I was born with a small bladder, right? And you'll hear things like that. So I think for us, the screening becomes very easy and natural because of the IPSS. But anytime you visit a doctor, and I would love to say that my office is not guilty of this, but you know, on that first visit, you get a stack of papers and it's like financial form. Exactly. You have financial forms. You've got all these screening things. And I think for the internist, you know, they're covering a tremendous amount of material. Yeah. Is it a realistic ask to be like, hey, add on this IPSS. Oh, wait, while you're at it, why don't you add on the sexual function score too? So it's kind of like, you know, it's hard for them to incorporate a lot because they're covering a lot of material.
I guess it'd be kind of cool if one day, like I'm in my 50s now, and if I was going to make an appointment with a primary care doc ahead of time, they sent me the, like you were talking about, remote diagnostics or a phone app, and hey, as part of your 50, you're a guy, we need to get a baseline for where you're at, here's a link, and go ahead and bring that in for your visit. I think that might be a fun way for us to get more data early on and get that bladder health baseline so we can compare down the road and have something to measure against.
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot to, if you look at the modern devices, like the Oura Ring, you've got like the Whoop, you've got the Apple Watch, right? And it's like, you look at the metrics they're able to capture in terms of like, you know, your symmetric gait, your heart rate variability, right? I mean, the question is, does it just need a porcelain detector, right? In other words, like, is it able to detect when you walk into the bathroom? Is that what we need? Or maybe, you know, with those sleep disturbances, like, you know, is it like, hey, did you get up to go to the bathroom, right? Maybe we need something like that to sort of like, oh, wow, this is not what I should be doing.
I think it'll be, we're really engaged now in that whole golden era of bladder diagnostics now. And I think what you brought up about the ambulatory urodynamics, getting the value of the quantitative multi-channel data, but from ambulatory, can you speak to that a little bit? So how can it help paint a picture for OAB, for example, that might be have some value?
Yeah, I mean, as we know, I mean, when you do urodynamics, there's a fair number of patients that, you know, unable to void, couldn't void with the catheter in. You know, they emptied very poorly, but you've never seen them empty poorly with a uroflow. There's a slew of reasons why a single urodynamics could be challenging. I think in this era where, you know, you've got the Bright Uro device, which is, you know, it seems like it'll be coming out soon, right? That device, like placing that inside the bladder and having the patient do multiple fill and empty cycles and getting, you know, the two suppressors while they're emptying could be a tremendous way for us to get more accurate information. I mean, if you have repeated fill and empty cycles, I think it's really helpful. And I think that's the beauty of like the home apps as well for Uroflow, is that you're not looking at a single void, you're looking at multiple voids to get an idea of what is this bladder really doing.
Kind of wrap up, I think there's so many great pearls and what you've brought up and your insight and wisdom from all your experience and expertise. I think for the listeners, who there are many out there who are rising urologists, but for you, kind of like, who's a urologist who advocates for bladder health that you admire in your career so far, and kind of why? Like, you've worked with so many amazing academics and so forth.
Yeah, it's hard to pinpoint like one person per se. I mean, I would say I've had, you know, a good number of mentors, you know, who have, you know, like I've worked with, you know, Steve Kaplan, Alex Tay. I think a lot of times when, you know, you'll see like, I think people have, I think on LinkedIn, like, Wayne, I actually look up to your, you know, this analogy of the heart health that you have as well. I think, you know, also like the, a lot of the colleagues that are, a lot of our colleagues that work on the guidelines. I mean, we've got such good advocates in terms of like how to advance the field forward. And I think this idea of bladder health has become something that's becoming much more, I think it's becoming much more recognized. I think, you know, we need more data to sort of show what is the bladder doing at any significant point. I think that'd be really helpful.
I appreciate you kind of holding me back, because I get overexcited talking about bladder health. It's all about bladder health. It seems obvious to me. And I think, you know, as just a community doc, you know, we use qualitative research, which is every time it's 2:30 in the morning, they call us again for a difficult Foley for a guy who's 70 years old on medications. He's retaining 2 liters, can't pee. He's been on OAB medications and BPH medications. You know, that's the part that's contributing to burnout, right? Our specialty, 50% are burning out and burnt out, right? And how do we, this is going to be a really important focus for all of us, especially for the specialty of urology, because 30% of our clinical work is BPH. We have to find more efficient, more effective ways to make the BPH-OAB pathway as efficient as possible. And I'm excited to see where it goes. I don't, do you have any thoughts? Like, if you had a magic wand, I want 3 things that are going to happen right now. Like, are there certain things that you'd love to happen like today that would change your care?
I would love for us to see some type of biomarker. Like, in other words, if we had like an A1C for the bladder, being like, hey, I mean, clearly you're at like, you know, you're working at 30% of your bladder like efficiency, right? And you are likely to have a problem. I think that'd be incredible for that conversation to be like, you know, when patients come in, like they know their A1Cs, they know it really well, right? I think even blood pressures. I mean, you see how patients know their blood pressures. They're like, I'm usually not around the 120s. I'm usually around the 130s. Like, they know what it is. I think some type of diagnostic like that would be tremendously helpful to promote, to help the conversation, also help with screening. So in other words, they come into the primary care doctor, they get their, you know, bladder health score, right? And that helps facilitate the conversation. Because at the same time, like we talked about it, if we set a PVR of 50, right? Are we going to get too many referrals where a lot of these patients don't require treatment? But if we set it at, let's say, 300, maybe that's way too high, where it's sort of like we're getting people who are too late in the game. Maybe the answer is, you know, somewhere in the middle. But I think if we had some type of something to help us with like a biomarker, a diagnostic that was simple, easy to reproduce, something that, you know, patients, you know, primaries could do in their office or patients could do at home, I think it would really help, you know, get rid of that, not get rid of, but really reduce our exposure to the retention or, hey, this is the third time this guy's in retention. Like, you know, we've all seen it.
I guess I'm kind of hoping if we can get the home Uroflow apps, men hopefully may be able to know, hey, this is my Qmax. What's your Qmax, right? Or we could have competitions where, you know, pee like Ryan Reynolds or pee like Deadpool, right? I don't know if you know, back on LinkedIn 2 years ago, on one of his Rexham series, he actually was caught. He left his mic on and was caught peeing. So I took the audio from that and had one of the phone apps, actually phone app companies for Uroflow, chart it out. And I posted that and I was like thinking, that's so funny. Like if we have movie stars who can really advocate for bladder health, it could be a game changer, right?
Well, and, I mean, I think that's really what we're missing. I mean, we don't have like a celebrity champion for overactive bladder. So I think, I mean, obviously when it comes to incontinence as well, we don't really have a champion that's out there being like, look, I've got incontinence and, you know, this is the things I've done for it. So we don't really have a lot of that. And I think obviously with the social stigmas that go around urination and I think some of the social taboos about talking about urination, I think, you know, that does lead to delay in diagnosis.
Well, it's been great catching up, Bilal. We'll have to do it again. I think that I love the concepts of, you know, blame the organ we own. That leads to how we care for our patients. But understanding that's so complex and that we need to kind of come together to really find solutions for OAB and BPH and find the solutions in this golden era of therapeutics and diagnostics.
I agree. Well, Wayne, thank you for including me. I really enjoy this.
Super fun. I'll see you on the next one or hopefully at some other time.
Sounds great.